Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Welcome to episode 5 of the Brandel Chamblee podcast with Jaime Diaz. Good morning, Brandel.
Good morning, Jaime. Nice to be here.
Yes, sir. Today we're going to talk about next week's 119th U.S. Open in Pebble Beach, the challenge it will present, the setup, how this is a big moment for the USGA. Also, I'd like to talk about Brooks Koepka, who's become a transformational player and somewhat of an enigma in terms
of how he's accomplished it.
But first, let's talk about, Brandel, your experience last week at the Principal Charity Classic in Des Moines on the PGA Tour Champions. You know, I admire so much that you're putting yourself in the arena out there and love to hear your assessments each week. This was your first Champions Tour, or at least Senior Tour, Senior Golf event since last year at the Senior Open. And, you know, you're going at it as hard as you can, given all your other commitments, and it's quite admirable. But tell me what you felt after that's over.
It was invigorating. I loved it, even though I, you know, played a little worse than I thought I would. But I almost look at what I'm doing as sort of a re-education. You know, it's been 15, 16 years since I've played competitive golf with any consistency. I've played one or two events since then, But really, I do just want to jump back out into the game and refamiliarize myself with not only how hard this game is, but also all of the newer aspects of it. You know, how players train, how they get fitted for equipment, who they're working with, all of the diagnostic measurement devices that the players have. And, you know, look, I have a goal of winning out there. It may be preposterous for some people, but, you know, not like I was a superstar, but I've won on every level I've ever played on, from junior golf all the way to the PGA Tour. So the one level that I have not really obviously even played, but it is still a goal of mine. And to do that, yes, I have a full-time job. So I'm trying to be as efficient about my time as I can so that I can practice as much as I can, so that when I get out there, I can be competitive, certainly more competitive than I was at this last one. Although I had a number of really good shots and I had my moments, but for the most part, it was frustrating, you know, because I couldn't do the things that I wanted to do to compete the way I wanted to compete. But that just means I'm just going to work that much harder, mm-hmm. You know, between now and the end of the year.
And some of those things entail maybe exploring more into technique. You're going out to California, and you told me you're going to talk to an instructor that's very intriguing, and also do some club fitting.
That's right. You know, I am. I think there are some great advances being made in teaching. I really do. And I work primarily with a fellow by the name of Lucas Wald, who sort of has his, I think, early start under the tutelage, of this. This fellow out in Hawaii who is I think on the forefront of the biomechanics of the game, and there's another fellow by the name of George Gankus, who is quite popular with the younger set, very successful, I think, in a couple of areas. He's successful in gaining a tremendous amount of club head speed, but in the shallowing out, in the transition of golf swings. I've never seen a teacher who's had such an impact on the ability to get players to shallow out. That's always been a big mystery. So you go back and you start to look at the, you know, some of the best ball strikers of all time. They should get shallow very quickly and right on plane in transition. Hogan obviously comes to mind, but Byron Nelson doesn't get a lot of credit for how well he shallowed the club out.
For a guy with an upright swing and then just became flat spot.
That's right. Yeah. But I mean, it just completely shallowed out beautifully in transition, almost like Nick Price. And when you ask people, and for the 20, 30 years that I've, you know, been studying the golf swing intently, and you ask instructors how Nick Price, for example, or Joe Durant were able to shallow the club out, you'd get as many different answers as you ask teachers. it was a mystery. But I do believe that George has, to a large extent, figured out exactly the stretch shorten cycles that exist at the top of the golf swing, or that should exist, so that you reverse the process and go from steep to shallow. You know, you look at Jack Nicklaus's golf swing, and all of a sudden it comes into much greater focus. I do believe that, you know, at the top of his backswing, he had his right shoulder in internal rotation, and he flew his right arm such that in transition, the shaft reversed the process and laid down. The effect of that is that you can hit as hard as you want when you're on plane. You don't have to make any compensating moves in the middle of the downswing. So, the Kelvin Miriara is the fellow, I think, who did a lot of this work. A lot of people poached from him, learned from him. And, you know, from that, you got all of these wonderful fingers of great teaching. Like I said, Lucas Wald, George Gankas are just a couple of them. But anyway, yes, I'm headed out tonight, actually, to spend some time with George tomorrow. And then I'm going to go down to San Diego and go to the TaylorMade Fitting Studio and refamiliarize myself with the whole process of getting fit with equipment. Partly, you know, for my job, but also partly because I'm looking for the best equipment that I can find to put in my bag.
When was the last time you were fit?
It's been a long time. Yeah. I mean, I've always, you know, for the last 10, 15 years, mostly, I just go buy equipment and take it out and mess with it myself. And if it doesn't fit me, which mostly it doesn't because it is a somewhat tedious process, I give it away. Mm-hmm. So, I can't tell you how many thousands of dollars I've spent on equipment and then just giving it away. But I've gone through, I guess, you know, fitting for drivers, and I went through a fitting maybe about 6 years ago. And the clubs were good. They were a little too hot, believe it or not, for my taste. Mm-hmm. that I got fitted for. So I ended up, you know, I have irons in my bag that are probably 10 years old. I have a driver that's 17 years old. I do have a new 3-wood that I got last week at the Principal Charity Classic. That, you know, listen, the advances in 3-woods are crazy. I've actually talked to a few of the people whose job it is to make equipment and wondered why they didn't build more forgiveness into a 3-wood. You know, recent studies show on the PGA Tour that you give a tour player's choices between hitting driver 3-wood on a hole, they choose to hit 3-wood. As often or more often, they're going to hit that 3-wood in the rough.
Yeah, that's amazing.
The driver's easier to hit.
Yeah.
Now that is, you know, counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. You think you're hitting the 3-wood to find the fairway, when in effect it's really costing players. So, you know, I've wondered why they haven't built more forgiveness into the 3-wood, but they have built more pop into the 3-wood. I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. You know, last week I was 250 front edge and able to get to the front edge with my 3-wood.
Well, maybe you'll find a driver that has that extra pop.
Maybe. I somehow think the extra pop that's in a 3-wood came from no pop in a 3-wood to now rebound effect.
Yeah,
I don't think they put all
their energy into the driver.
If there's any more rebound in a driver, I don't think it would pass.
Well, that's going to be intriguing because obviously you've made some changes in your golf swing over these last you've learned, and maybe it will require some things that you haven't seen in your own fitting.
Yeah, so trying to. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to get back to more how I swung. You know, when I was in college, you know, I had a bigger golf swing. I flew my right arm, certainly more upright, more hip turn, and. You know, I maybe wasn't the longest in college, but I was longer than most. And, you know, I lost a lot of that when I played the tour.
Yeah.
I became, you know, for the bulk of my career, I was probably a, you know, average distance. You know, 1 year I did finish 49th in driving distance, as the best I ever finished. But by the end of my career, 2001, 2003, as the Pro V1 came into play, or the solid core golf ball, I should say, because, look, I mean, Spalding beat them to the punch. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Bridgestone came along, Nike came along. So I guess, you know, there were plenty of solid core ball options out there. It just changed the game. Everybody got very, very long. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the game became, you know, inundated with power hitters, and that's where we're at now.
Got it. I'm curious one last thing about this. as an analyst, you're a lightning rod sometimes, and you would imagine going in the locker room, there are probably players there, whether they're verbal about it or keep it to themselves, who would probably like to see you fail because yeah. you're judging them, and they probably resent, you know, that whole dynamic and, you know, kind of want to see you get your comeuppance without, you know, without putting too fine a point on it. I just wonder if you're aware of that sentiment, and does it have an effect on you? Are you self-conscious in any way? Do you feel like extra burden to overcome or prove them wrong in any way, or afraid that they will, you know, be validated in their feelings in any way?
I suppose it comes with the territory. You know, when I played the tour, and you know, even this way, last week, I very much enjoyed the other players. Mm-hmm. I would not call myself, I don't think anybody who knew me would have called me controversial or combative. It's just the nature of my job. I mean, those that take issue with the way I do my job, that's fair enough. I've had their job for mm-hmm. 20 years. They haven't had my job for 5 minutes. If they came and did my job, I suspect if they had any ambitions of doing the job correctly, they would be very much just like me. I mean, I'm asked to make relative judgments every 2-3 minutes. So those that have an issue with it, for the most part, they keep it to themselves, I guess, because, mm-hmm. you know, I ran into a lot of people last week who said, you know, love your work, keep at it, keep going. And I suppose those that have an issue, you know, just kept it to themselves. But, yeah, sure, I'm aware a lot of people would love to see me fail. You know, it doesn't bother me. I think Tiger Woods summed it up better than anybody last year when he was at a clinic. I know you probably saw this online, but he was asked about his intimidation, and I think he said something along the lines of he was aware of it, and I think he was asked something like, do you have any sympathy for them? And he said, if I intimidate you, that's your own freaking fault.
Yeah.
Although he used another word, and I thought that's exactly right. You know, if you let something else get in your head, like the idea that the world mm-hmm. Many people would love to watch me fail. It's my own fault. You know, I need to be focused on what I need to be focused on mm-hmm. When I'm out there playing. And getting completely absorbed in, wrapped up in the process of playing golf, it's a beautiful spot, you know, to get to. You know, when you see a shot in your mind and you're able to make the move that you know you can make and pull the shot off, it's a beautiful moment. It's why it's really hard to get people off a golf course mm-hmm. to come to commentating, because you just cannot duplicate the thrill of competition and the thrill of discovery. You know, Hogan said somewhere that, you know, he wished there were more hours in the day and that he loved every minute of the time he spent hitting golf balls. And you know, I can tell you firsthand, you know, it wakes you up at 4:30. You know, I was up at 5 o'clock yesterday morning. I got to the golf course before the sun came up just to go hit golf balls. And, you know, that's a day after being home.
Yeah.
You know, it's an incredible rush and thrill to go out and try to solve the problems of this game and the mysteries of it. You know, you're trying to remember what you forgot. And yet there are things, you know, I've learned that, and there's a line that starts Moneyball. I believe it's attributed to Mickey Mantle. It said, something to the effect of, it's unbelievable how a game you've played your entire life, you realize you know so
little about
few about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm so little about it. Something along those lines. It's unbelievable that you can play a game your whole life and know so little about it. And I think there's still a lot of mystery to this game, and every single player is different, their body is different, it changes day to day, year to year, so you always have to make these adjustments to your body, to your golf swing. You're always fighting the demons. All those things are fun, and it's I think it's good for my job to come back and sort of have a better understanding of the golfer's plight.
That's beautifully said, and I think it sums up why you're a great analyst, because you're looking at the mystery from the greatest, you know, perspective you can have, which is on the golf course in competition.
Right. You know, it is wonderful to get out there. You know, I do exhaustive research, you know, I watch on TV, but it is hard to replace what you learn when you're out there. You know, it is hard to dig that up. The tactile sensation of hitting good shots and the frustration of trying to get your body to do what you know it needs to do, and you know, the struggle in the gym to get your body to where it will behave the way it needs to behave for you to be able to do the things you need to do. And the strive for excellence that is so pervasive now on the tour. I mean, not that there didn't used to be, but you know, when I played the tour, if you lost your tour job, or say 20 years before I got on the tour, if you lost your tour job, you know, for the most part, you were losing a job that paid you well. Don't get me wrong, paid you well, but it didn't pay you well enough for your extended family, generations beyond you, to be set up for life, which is how well players can get paid now. You know, Tiger Woods changed things exponentially. So the attention to detail on the PGA Tour now is significantly more than when I was out there. They can hire experts to be with them, and you know, to some extent, I think those experts need to back off when it comes time to play. But I do understand the need to hire those experts, not because it's guaranteed that they know something that you don't, but there's a possibility that they might know something that you don't that could help you. There's also a possibility that they hurt you, but to not turn that stone over comes with a risk, you know, because someone's going to come along who's going to assemble a team or assemble the information, you know, and I think it's appropriate, you know, as we are now getting ready to talk about the U.S. Open in 2000, and because of what Tiger did, it's still relevant. You know, he found a golf ball shortly before he got there that allowed him to have power and control to the extent that he never had, and that had a lot to do with him winning by 15 shots there.
Yeah.
So again, that was him assembling the pieces to the puzzle and beating his competition with talent and research.
And,
so.
And the effect is never greater than when you first discover it, usually,
well,
right? When
that's true.
You click into something. I'm not saying it was a placebo, but it made him probably feel like, I've got superpowers all of a sudden.
Well, when you first discover it, that means others haven't discovered it.
True.
And then they catch up, and you've got to go make new discoveries.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, to be on the cutting edge as an athlete is hard because you spend a lot of time, you know, trying to get your body and your mind and your golf swing right. But then to have equipment that is as out of touch with everybody else as your talents
ability
are,
is, yeah.
Well, then you win by 15 shots.
Thank you. Well, Pebble Beach, here we go.
Yeah.
It's classic. Tell me just your thoughts of Pebble as an open venue. What is it the ideal one? Is it something?
It is the ideal, I think, venue for the U.S. Open. It's proven to be a place that really does divine out incredible athletes. You know, Nicholas Watson, Kite Woods, and Graham McDowell. People will say, you know, Graham McDowell maybe doesn't belong in that class, but you know. You know, Nicholas had won 41 times when he got there in 72. Watson had won 30 times. Kite had won 16 times. Woods had won 19 times. So it was clear that they were, you know, the best of the best. And Graham had won 5 times in Europe when he got there. And he was exactly what you're looking at when you go to Pebble Beach. You know, somebody who's very precise. And people say, hold on a second, Tom Watson wasn't precise. But the year that he won the U.S. Open there, he was in the top 50 in driving accuracy. So it was a very precise year for him, given how far he hit the golf ball. And he was able to win there. But, you know, great scramblers who are precise. And, you know, beyond that, you know, the golf course is on everybody's short list of favorites. And there's something about Pebble Beach that makes you excited that you went down this path. Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember playing there with Peter Jacobson in the AT&T going down 18. We were both playing well. I think we were both in the top 10. And, you know, the waves were crashing and the sun was out. And, you know, he looked at me and he was like, you know, this is why I wanted to play professional golf. Same with me. I mean, that's what I dreamed of. Was, you know, I think when you, as a kid, at least when I was growing up, one of the first tournaments that made a mark on you was the Crosby. Mm-hmm. Then, yeah. Now the AT&T, you tuned in and all the stars were out there, and it was just the most beautiful scene, you know. And it still is that way. There's no other place quite like Pebble Beach that I've ever been in my life. It has its own aesthetics and charm unique to it in the same way that St. Andrews touches your soul.
Thank you. From your intelligence, what are you gathering is going to be this kind of setup they're going to have?
You know, I think the U.S., first of all, the USGA is under the spotlight, you know, almost more so than any player there. They get criticized a lot for mistakes they've made in the past, but I don't think they get the credit that they deserve for running some very good championships. You know, 98, because of what happened in 98, and I was playing at Olympic that year, I was actually first off, so when I got to the 18th hole, my putt went up and came back.
Came back to you.
Yeah, and I thought, my goodness, it's going to be a mess. Nobody talks about how beautiful 99 was. Mm-hmm. Daly had a Chernobyl moment there, a meltdown. But, you know, look, it doesn't take – if McDonald's runs out of Diet Coke, he has a meltdown. So, you know, I don't think we use that as the litmus test for the absurdity of the golf courses. 99 at Pinehurst was beautiful. 2000 – at Pebble was a wonderful setup. I played in 2001 as well at Southern Hills. 9 and 18, you know, they were a bit problematic. They had to slow those greens down, so they were different speeds. But again, you go through, they didn't really have an issue except for obviously 2004, mm-hmm. huge issue. And then they had relatively, you know, controversy-free major championships until 2015. And then they've had a bad run. 15, it was a mess. That's no place to play championship golf. No condition. You know, it's almost inexcusable. And then what happened in 2016 is still inexcusable with Dustin Johnson. Nobody can make sense of that ruling. Not 3 years down the road. 2017, Aaron Hills was, you know. I don't think too many people look at that as a good choice, even though it was a fine golf course. Mm-hmm. It's just not a good choice for U.S.
Open. Didn't have the character for U.S.
Open. No, not at all. Shouldn't. You know, you shouldn't be playing a U.S. Open on a golf course with fairways that wide. And, you know, I think the setup at Shinnecock was not what they were looking for, certainly not what players were looking for. So, yeah, they're it's almost as if they're trying to mitigate the results of oversights that they've had. It's like they created the problem, and now they're trying to mitigate the effects of the problem.
You're talking about the problem being increased distance.
That's right. Now it was because of their oversight that the rebound effect in drivers was allowed to go unchecked until the early 2000s. You know, it was written into the rules that there was not to be a rebound effect. Well, lo and behold, here they come, big distance gains, and then combined with the solid core golf ball, and you get the problem that we have right now. So it was under their watch that these effects came about, and they're trying to mitigate them with sort of tricked-up golf. And along the way, they lost their identity. You know, the majors, the four majors, all had an identity. The Masters was about creativity and escape and touch. The U.S. Open was about intimidation, attrition, and execution. That's what it was. That's what it always was. That's what it was meant to be. We can thank Joe Dye for that, perhaps, but I think he had the right idea, because you don't want to mess with the philosophy of the Masters. They have their identity. The Open was about getting back in touch with, you know, the roots of the game and fighting Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. And then the PGA was every man's major. You know, it was, we're going to set up a golf. It's so hot, first of all, that we have to set up a golf course that is soft enough that it doesn't die mid-PGA. So it was sort of every man's major. There you go. You had your four majors. But when they the USGA started messing around with graduated rough, you know, I think they lost their identity. And they allowed for the mistake and the recovery. I don't want to see a mistake and a recovery. Sure, I mean, if they recover, great. But I don't want it to become the main theme of the U.S. Open, which is more or less what the U.S. Open became.
Well, I take your point. I wonder, though, with as many complaints as there have been about the setup and the unfairness of the U.S. Open and being tricked up, to have graduated rough at the time was considered a movement, a progressive move, because it was more fair.
The players thought
it,
that.
It punished in a proportional way.
Right.
The farther you missed the fairway, the deeper the rough you were
in. Right.
But you feel that it actually hurt the integrity of the tournament because it didn't test that intimidation and that execution to the same extent.
That's right. I mean, in theory, graduated rough sounds good on paper. But that means that if you miss the fairway by 2-3 feet, you have a better lie than the guy who missed the fairway by 20 feet. In theory, that sounds great. It does. But what ends up happening is that everybody can play out of the rough, especially as far as they hit the golf ball now. The U.S. Open used to be about standing up on the tee and knowing that if you missed the fairway by a foot, you were more than likely to give up a shot. Now that's a cognitive exercise.
Yes,
that's about intimidation.
I know Mark O'Meara never had great U.S. Opens because he was somewhat crooked, not real crooked. But at the U.S. Open, he was crooked enough to be as crooked as anybody because
right.
he missed the fairway by 2 yards.
That's right.
And he always felt like that is just not fair. And it seemed like Mike Davis's decision to go to graduated rough when he took over in 2006 was a solution to that, and that we're going to have a better U.S. Open.
Bad solution. Bad idea. Bad solution.
Okay.
It's not meant to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to set out criteria that you must adhere to, and if you don't, you're just simply not going to win that championship. Mark O'Meara won his championships. He mm-hmm. won in places where he could recover from the occasional inaccurate drive.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted a place, again, great, great recovery skills, great pitcher of the ball, great chipper of the ball, great putter of the ball. And it's appropriate that he wanted Augusta National and the Open Championship. Those are two places mm-hmm. where you can do that.
Yeah.
The U.S. Open is about not just how good your golf swing is, it's about how good your mind is and how you can deal with intimidation, or it used to be. It used to be. It's become very much like every other championship. It doesn't put a premium on having a great brain, a quiet mind, and the ability to find a narrow fairway with a very high cost if you miss it.
But your understanding is that Pebble is going to be, as you put it, we were talking earlier, your grandfather's Open. It's going to be.
That's what I'm hearing,
yeah.
is that it's going, the USGA is going to get back to what made the U.S. Open the premier major championship in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that it would be, if you asked 100 touring pros, they wouldn't put it there. The majority of them would not make it the premier, let's say 100 touring pros, who hail from the United States, because if you hail from anywhere else, it's likely that you're going to say the Open Championship is, or the Masters, but certainly not the U.S. Open. But the U.S. Open used to be the championship that everybody wanted to win. It should be back there, because, if you listen to the players, it's not to say that the players don't have good ideas. It's not. But for the most part, the players are going to argue for fairness.
Yeah.
It's their job to play a golf course that philosophically has sort of been, it's meted out, vetted out, designed to bring a type of player out. Now, what type of player is that? Well, at the height, it's the smartest, the calmest, the clearest head.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the type of player. Look, Seve didn't win the U.S. Open.
Yeah, didn't.
Okay, he didn't. But Seve's a great artist. He was beautiful in the Open. He was beautiful at the Masters. That's why we look at the players who've won all four major championships in a different way, because we look at those players as having the diversity in every single aspect of the game. You know, creativity, the ability to battle the elements, the ability to battle the heat, and the ability to deal with the intimidation of a USGA setup. I hear that they're going back to that, that they're getting away from the graduated rough. This is applause. Well done. You're about 10 years too late, but well done. Good. Get after it. You need to have thick rough, narrow fairways, and then reasonable greens. They don't need to be insane.
If you have a lot of rough, you don't maybe have to edge towards such a fine line
such
on the green.
Absurdities. Uh-huh. Yeah, they need to channel their inner Joe Dye, tee to green, and Kerry Haig on the greens. That's what they need to do.
Well, this is really an interesting idea. At the same time, it is one that possibly could cause a lot of angst and a lot of agitation and a lot of criticism from the players, which has been happening a lot with the USGA recently, fairly or unfairly. They're under the gun. Are they in a position to take that risk with a setup that might actually draw more criticism than if they played what they had been, as you say, the graduated rough? It's a bold move if they're going to do that because of the public relations situation they are in currently.
Well, I think they start getting in trouble when they start getting worried about the criticism and answering the criticism. They need to channel their inner Joe Dye and say, I'm sorry, but this is the setup of the U.S. Open. We want to test the mettle of players. Now, they've hired a couple of different people whose job it is to, sort of make nice with the players and handle the PR. And I think they found a wonderful person to do just that. Jason Gore has been hired by the USGA. He's an extremely popular player, with the players. Affable, smart, good player. So he's out there talking to the players, sort of saying, look, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. In this day and age, I think that's good. So they don't show up and get shocked and then start a social media firestorm.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you go back to Aaron Hills and there was a social media firestorm because the players got there and they couldn't believe just off the, outside of the smallest miss parameters of the rough, let's say, there was 3-foot rough. And the next day they mowed it down. They shouldn't be reacting to that. Mm-hmm. They should have enough foresight, enough thoughts about how the golf course should play, and then stick with it. I think that's where they're at. I think that's what they're going to do. I don't think they'll Pebble Beach is a place where if they try to get the greens running 14, they're going to have problems like they did in 1992 where there simply wasn't enough grass on the greens to to soften the blow of the Poania.
Mm-hmm.
You put that with the fierce winds that can blow this time of year out there, or any time of year out there for that matter, and you get the scores that they had that Sunday, the scores that they had, I think, in 72 on Sunday, that they averaged just under 80, 78.8, I believe is what they averaged. So since the war is the highest Sunday average in the U.S. Open. So, even though Pebble's not long, you set the golf course up difficult and fair, Mother Nature will do the rest.
Last year there was a lot of sort of Sturm und Drang over the rules, the new rules, and to the point where the players were really criticizing vociferously, even doing, pantomimes on the golf course. Jay Monahan finally stepped in and said, guys, let's cool this. Because it's disrespectful, frankly, and counterproductive, I would imagine, to the authority of the USGA and the respect for the USGA. So do you feel like the players have gone, because they've been enabled in some respects because of the USGA's mistakes and maybe the climate in social media and everywhere else that, exacerbates those mistakes in a public way where they weren't necessarily as widespread in terms of the people just taking it in as a big issue. It was an inside golf issue, an inside baseball issue, so to speak. Now it's become the lead story sometimes. So do you feel like this is something the players have a responsibility to temper, or is the cart out of the barn and the USGA has become a pincushion until further notice?
Well, I think there's always been criticism of the USGA. You go back and you go to newspapers.com, Google criticism of the USGA, and you will get snippets of criticism from every U.S. Open by premier players, as far back as you want to look. It's their job to, they're an authoritative figure. They're the caretaker of the game. They're going to make decisions that are inevitably going to be unpopular. Now, they're not doing it with malice in mind. They're doing it for the betterment of the game. I think the fact that they allow the pin to be left in was hugely unpopular. It didn't seem to be well thought out. Dropping from knee height seems a bit ridiculous. You feel ridiculous doing it. It would have been easier probably to say, no lower than knee height, no higher than waist height, something like that, so you didn't have to bend down and scoop or curtsy while you were doing it. But we live in an age where everybody has a voice. Mm-hmm. And, do you care? I mean, if you're the USGA, do you really care? I mean, you shouldn't care. You should know what you had in mind. You have the betterment of the game in mind. And inevitably, players are going to get upset. And let's say 20 players tweet something. Well, there's hundreds, thousands that play the game professionally. 20 players tweet something. And you're always going to get the dregs of society who are unhappy with every aspect of their life are going to jump on Twitter and beat any drum that's negative. You can't allow those people to define the narrative. Why do we allow negativism that is inevitable on any social media to define the narrative?
Yeah.
We have such a negative bias, all of us. And if there's one thing that social media should teach all of us is to fight that beast. Don't let negative our negative biases control the narrative. The USGA, they were trying to do the right thing, speed up the game, make the rules more palatable, more digestible. I think for a large part they did that. I just played last week, had a couple of instances where players hit it way offline. 3 minutes goes by really fast.
Yeah.
And you got to get on with it. Putting with the pin in, believe it or not, as ill-conceived as I think the idea was, you had a 50-footer. No longer do you ask your caddy to go up and tend it. You just get on with it. Initially, I think it makes you putt with a pin in for two reasons. One, it's faster, and two, because if you hit a poor putt and it's dead on line, the pin's going to stop it. So, they had the right idea, which is to speed up the game. So. They're nice people, the USGA. I've met a lot of them. Don't many of them real well, but they're nice people, and they're embedded in the game of golf. They're not these evil empire lawyers sitting in a room trying to ruin the lives of touring professionals.
Well, I think it's admirable that they do stand on principle and they do stand on tradition. I think it's more difficult in this time, and there's also the fragility that David Fay pointed out, the ex-executive director. We rule by the power not vested in us. In other words, there's no official, legal...
That's a great line.
Yeah, no
That's
legal status line. That the USG... Nobody has to follow them. And I think that idea started not to gain currency, but started to, occur to people. Like, why are they, all-knowing and all-powerful? And I think maybe in a world where everybody has a voice, their authority has been questioned more than it might have. And I hope the pushback from them is, for the betterment of everybody, you want an authority. And we're the best position to do it.
That's right. These are smart men and women. I go back to the 74 U.S. Open when players were putting it off the first green. I think 7 over 1. And they wrote a book about it, you know, The Massacre at Wingfoot. And that was the year that Joe Dye had the greatest line, I think, ever uttered by an administrator, that we're not trying to embarrass the best players, we're trying to identify them. And what difference does it make if 7 over is the winning score, 7 under? The score is irrelevant. It's about putting the players through a test, a mental test, a physical test, a technical test. And that's what the U.S. Open is supposed to be. It's supposed to test all aspects of your game. That's not my business to run tournaments, but if it were, you know, sitting where I'm sitting now with just the passing thoughts of how to set it up, I think I want to test technique, I want to test strength, I want to test touch, and I want to test their minds. More than anything, I want them to have to think. And that means dealing with adversity and having patience. Impatient players shouldn't win the U.S. Open. You know, they just shouldn't. You know, they should be meted out, kicked to the side, abused and humbled and told to go grow up.
Yeah.
That's what the U.S. Open is meant to do. And if you can't do it, well, you know, good luck.
There's other majors.
There's other majors, but not this one.
Yes.
You're meant to be a mature badass,
yeah.
Tee to green. Male or female. That's what the USGA was to me growing up, and I'm desperately hoping that's what they get back to.
Just for the record, not to, you know, be pedantic here, but it was Sandy Tatum who had that great quote.
Sandy Tatum.
It's okay.
Yes,
it's okay.
Yeah, see, another great guy.
No, he was a great guy.
Yeah, that's right.
Rest in peace, Sandy.
Thank you.
We lost him a couple of years ago.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. My bad. Thank you for that.
No, not at all.
That's one of the reasons I love you.
Just last thing about Pebble. What do you think they need to accomplish that would help the situation? Just as you're saying, stick to your guns, but what at the end of the day on Sunday evening, what would be a good result for the future of the USGA from Pebble?
To go controversy free. We said it last year, you know, to go controversy free, and then, you know, they just couldn't help themselves. And, you know,
I think it was an inadvertent error in defense of them, but it happened.
Yeah.
Inopportune.
They knew the weather forecast. The weather forecast was there. It wasn't different than they said it was.
They knew it needed more water if the water didn't get put on, yeah, for whatever reason on Friday night.
But it's not like it's the first time they got to that golf course. They knew, when you go talk to members there, that whole location was very dangerous. Everybody knew it. And to push the envelopes, like, why take that chance? For what reason would you take it? And why are you taking that chance? Why would you take that chance? Your job is to set up a golf course. You know this golf course inside and out. You have people on your staff whose sole mission is to help you, who are familiar with that golf course, who are members there, to tell you the dangerous spots and to avoid them, to go controversy free. You know, inevitably, you know, Mother Nature could go on a tear at the Open Championship, and
it certainly didn't know at Pebble in '92. I recall that.
Right.
They couldn't get over the rough on 6 in the second shot because the wind was so hard. Excuse me.
Yeah. I played '92. I played 2000 at Pebble Beach. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a fair bit of rough there, and some controversy in '92. Yeah. No controversy in 2000 because everybody was apoplectic looking at Tiger Woods, but. Yeah, to go controversy-free again, but let's not pretend it's easy to do what they want to do. Well, they want to set up a golf course that is very challenging and hopefully get back to the rough. And if Mother Nature comes along, they have to be very conservative. You know, the PGA Championship, you know, when's the last controversy that they had at the PGA Championship? When's the last controversy they had at Augusta?
But
when's the last controversy they had at the Open?
I think Augusta's masterful because they do have a golf course that has a lot of variables. The PGA
but,
Championship
But they
plays,
have the benefit of knowing that golf
they
course
know it,
very well.
Yes. I would just say about the USGA, because I admire their mission, which is the ultimate test of golf. They're trying to get closer to the line. And as a result, it's easier to go over the line. That's not an excuse, but they are playing on with narrower margins on a tighter tightrope. And, you know, you never want to see, you know, a bad mistake. But I think they should be forgiven for the small mistake now and then in the interest of that challenge. And
they
you were mentioning that challenge yourself.
They would be if those small mistakes didn't happen one on top of
the
other.
There's no question.
So
they would admit.
It's tough to get past Chambers Bay. It's tough to get past the ruling at Oakmont. Those are And it is tough to get past that whole location on Saturday last year at Shinnecock. Those are three mistakes in 4 years that will linger, you know, like a bad smell for a while, you know. So, you know, they need to have a mistake free week, and you know they've got a different person setting up the golf course. They've got PR people now. You know, I think the players will be, I think, more inclined now that they've got sort of a liaison in Jason Gay and Jason Gore.
Yeah.
You know, now that Jason Gore, and they've got a wonderful PR person, I believe, in with Craig Annis.
Mm-hmm. Jason Driscoll, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the players will have sort of a softer ear, I think, when they get to, or a lighter touch on social
that
media.
That may be counter to what others' expectations, but I hope they do have a little empathy. This is a big moment, and
it is. Yeah, yeah. Pebble Beach makes everybody more reflective.
In a good mood.
Yeah, I think so, for the most part.
That's good. Let's move on to Brooks Koepka, who's a fascinating study. What he's accomplished, you know, if he happens to win at Pebble, it'll be 5 out of 9. Nobody's ever won 5 out of 9 except Tiger, who won 5 out of 6 and 7 out of 11. But no, I was looking it up, and I had some researchers help me. No player, if you're talking about consecutive majors, if you skipped a major, that's still counted as a major, you know, attempt. No one's ever won 5 out of 9. So Brooks Koepka has become this specialist and this very special character study in golf. So what are your, and you've commented on him and been criticized, and, you know, and you have, I know, evolving thoughts about him. What are they?
I do, you know, what he did at Bethpage certainly changed my view of him. To play alongside Tiger Woods, to shoot 63 in the first round with Tiger Woods, you know, I said it at the time, I believe it, it's the best golf that, in my view, that Tiger Woods would have ever seen, that he didn't author. No player of that talent ever threw that kind of golf at Tiger Woods while playing with Tiger Woods. You know, to withstand the chaos of the Tiger Woods arena and the intimidation of Tiger Woods himself. You know, Tiger's become much more affable with his peers. They're not his peers anymore. They're a generation removed from being his peers, or two. But, you know, I think that helps eliminate a little bit of that intimidation. You know, Tiger's friends with these players. I don't think he could have said that in, you know, earlier part of Tiger Woods' career. You know, it's almost like the Hogan-Jack Fleck sort of syndrome where...
Yeah, Hogan, you know, was nice to Fleck.
He was nice to Fleck, and Fleck played unbelievable golf and beat Hogan. But the chaos of that world is still huge, and to see Koepka do what he did was marvelous. I loved it. It was the type of golf I don't know if I've ever seen. No, I've never seen anybody play the first two rounds of a major championship better than what Brooks did. And you know, that golf course had thick rough. It was a beast. It was hugely impressive, and to see somebody do that, and not look ahead and think, well, he's capable of doing exactly what he said. You know, for him
double
to
double digits, yeah.
And what he did the week, you know, the whole week, saying that majors were the easiest to win, explaining in detail why they were the easiest to win, to literally say this is what I'm going to do and then go do it. I can't think of another player that's ever done that. Never. I've never, ever heard a player go into the media center and so accurately predict themselves winning a major championship. He kind of did it at Shinnecock, which, again, I've spoken to here and many times, and you know, I was hugely impressed when he won those major championships, his first three. But they were, at least in my view, all sort of on the same golf course, wide open. Or no huge penalty for missing a fairway. That's not the case with Bethpage. And he got up there again and said, majors are the easiest to win. I see no reason why I can't win double digits. which is preposterous to say. And then he went out and did it. I mean, this is, you know, these are the predictive poems of Muhammad Ali. you know, that's what made Muhammad, well, one of the many things that made Muhammad Ali so appealing was he could tell you what he was going to do.
Yeah.
And then he was going to, and then he went and did it.
It ain't bragging if you can back
Nobody
it up.
Nobody does that in golf. Nobody well, has.
I was
just going to
say,
that.
Golf is the humbling game. You know, you don't want bravado, it's going to bite you.
Well, there are too many variables. When you get into a boxing ring, there's just you and that guy. And the poems were part of the intimidation, I have no doubt. And, you know, part of the fun and keeping himself loose. They served a purpose. There's always, the game of golf is so full of variables. You could tee off at 4 o'clock and be playing, or I'm sorry, 2:30 and be playing an entirely different golf course.
And you're not really playing another guy. You're playing the golf course and you're playing your own changing self that day.
That's right.
And you don't know what you're going to wake up with. And yet he had an incredible sense of self, a sense of centeredness. And, it's funny, you're very right. I can't recall anybody coming into the press room and being
never
in any way braggadocious. Maybe Greg Norman had some of that. But it felt a bit more sort of prepared and not organic. No, like he was almost talking to himself in a way.
It actually seemed authentic to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't get the sense that he was bragging.
You're talking about Brooks now.
When other players have even sniffed going that direction, I've felt like it was braggadocious.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was their insecurity manifesting in arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back and you can read Tiger's interviews in the media center. He was always very cagey, clever, but cagey about his expectations for the week. Tiger, are you the favorite this week? I think experience will matter this week.
Uh-huh.
I've been here before. I'm comfortable in this environment. He'd never directly answer the question. He would say things, do you think you have the advantage of this particular player tomorrow? I've done this. I've been here before. That'll matter. You know, those sorts of things. He would never.
He would never put himself out there.
Never.
As I'm going to
never,
do this.
Because obviously that he's very clever, Tiger, in that that would have become a headline.
Sure.
And it would have distracted him because he would have had to answer that question. And then he'd had to be more nuanced in his description. But Brooks just flat out said, majors are the easiest to win. Here's why.
Jack had said that. Jack never would say it before a major. He'd say it in reflection perhaps afterwards or in a feature story where he was, kind of away from competition.
That's right.
Was assessing his career.
That's right.
Never in a moment where he would have to back it up the next day.
That's right. And as far as I know, I never remember Jack at a major saying, I'm going to win double digits or I'm going to get to 18 or
no,
15.
As he said, he didn't know how many he had or that it was even a chase until 13 when somebody pointed out that's how many Bobby Jones had counting his amateurs.
Which, by the way, happened coincidentally in the 1972 Open at Pebble Beach. That was Jack's 11th professional men, so it tied him with Walter Hagen in professional majors. And it was his 13th overall
counting
major back when you count amateurs and tied him with Bobby Jones. So in 1 week, he tied the most professional major wins and the most major wins, including amateurs. So it was a momentous week. And he was certainly asked about it when he was – and he was reflective for sure. You know, I've read stories where he's like, I didn't really know. I didn't pay attention to it.
It was hard.
But I read that story, and he definitely knew.
Well, his dad was one of Bobby Jones's greatest fans.
He definitely knew
Bobby Jones's record. And Bobby Jones had been a great influence on Jack whenever he visited him at the Masters.
Mm-hmm.
Took him under his wing in some ways. But
Brooks is – what's great about Brooks is he's this – he's the opposite of Greg Norman. And I don't mean this as any disrespect to Greg Norman. I mean, Greg was an amazing player. 331 weeks as
number one
player.
Yeah.
I mean, miles better than anybody who – had a chance to, who was number one in the world with the exception of Tiger, who was miles better than Greg. Greg was a worldwide dominating player. But in the big ones, he was a disappointment. You know, I think Greg would admit that. I think he was a disappointment. He couldn't, he did not have the calmness or the reliability under pressure to get it done in the biggest events. That's become as much his legacy as his dominance and his power. You know, there are other athletes who had all the talent in the world but didn't get it done in the biggest ones. You know, Dan Marino, Ted Williams never won a World Series. So there's numerous examples of athletes who were prolifically talented and successful in their arenas except for the biggest events for whatever reasons. And the implication is that, you know, they let the moment get them. Does it see a player who it seems like he's bored in regular tour events? Mm-hmm. You know, where's he been since the U.S. Open? He hasn't even played. Where's he been since the PGA? Right. He hasn't even played. And it's like he's going to disappear and he's going to show up.
He's only won two.
You know, one more than me. Okay, a few more majors than me. But it's like he's bored. It's like, and this, I was explaining this to Billy Horschel, who I saw Billy Horschel. I was calling Colonial, and I walked off the set, and Horschel says, "Hey, Brandel, would you stop being an asshole?" I mean, I have that relationship with Billy Horschel. I love him. And I started laughing. I was like, "What are you talking about?" He was like, "You know, you're thinking with Koepka." I go, did you read the headline or did you hear exactly what I said in the context that I said it in?" I just basically said I needed more evidence, which he provided me. Anyway, we ended up having a wonderful conversation. Brooks is an enigma, as I was explaining. I said, is he the player who's only won two tour events, or is he the player who's won four major championships in a very short period of time? So that's the enigma. I can't decide who he is. But in the meantime, he just keeps winning major championships. So, you know, Serena Williams was a lot like that. I mean, she never mind. I mean, I think she won
her share.
Outside of majors.
But she would peak at majors.
She won right at 50 regular tournaments. 23 major championships. So a disproportionate number of major championships compared to her other victories. She just like show up and it was got the best out of her. And maybe we've never really had a player like that.
No.
You know, we've never in the history of the game, players who won majors at the clip that Brooks is winning them at, or anywhere close to that clip, won prolifically in regular tour events. So maybe that will be the next chapter of Brooks Koepka's career. Is in between majors, he'll dazzle us with the same talents that he has at major championships. But look, again, he's nowhere to be found. He wins the PGA. Off he goes. He turned down all media in New York City, which, part of me admires that. And mm-hmm. part of me thinks, well, this is part of the reason why you're overlooked is because you don't go make these media tours. He won in New York City. You know, all the media in the world is right there. All the shows in the world are right there. But on the other hand, he didn't want any part of that. He wanted to go celebrate with his team, and I admire that to some extent. I think that's impressive. Not to go bite or try to take advantage of the opportunities that his win afforded him in the media world.
Do you think there's a chance that he's actually the next sort of progression on the evolution of the player? In other words, I'm not saying he's better than Tiger, but I'm saying he's grown from that, you know, that period of time when Tiger was supreme. And in the interim, when Tiger lost his number one position, that 7 or 8, 10 years, and several others rose to that position, Rory, DJ, Jason Day, Jordan. A lot of these guys, very long hitters, very powerful, very gifted, seem to have a slight hole in their game.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere, usually in the short game, in the putter or the short game. DJ kind of plugged it up with the wedges. The putter probably still there a bit. In some cases, you know, like a Justin Rose, very complete, probably not the great closer. And now we're seeing in Brooks, I'm not saying everything, but very small holes, if any. So Are we short shrifting his game? We talk about his mental capacity and his strength and his grit. That's great. How about, and his stats don't necessarily reflect it, but does he have a level of game? And you said, you know, this is the best I've ever seen anybody play against Tiger head to head. That's the best golf Tiger's ever seen from an opponent. Does he have something that we're either underrating or hasn't been quite proven yet, but gives us a suspicion that it might be special?
Look, statistics summed up Tiger. You know, as much as we want to say they didn't sum up Tiger, because nobody had ever won at the clip Tiger won at. Statistically, he was a god. You know, he drove it 9 miles. He drove it with control. I'm talking about Tiger Woods, you know, 99, 2002. He hit his irons better than anybody else. He putted and chipped as well as anybody ever had seen. All of that was reflected in the statistics, and it was all reflected in his scoring averages. It was all reflected in his par 3, par 4, par 5. It was all reflected in his bounce back. It was all reflected in every delineation that you want to look at of statistics. You could find, if you just looked at that and didn't know who he was, you'd think this guy,
he's the best one,
is miles better than everybody else. His scoring average 67.79 in 2007 and 2000. Okay, upwards of 2 shots better than the next best player. Two shots. Okay, he was represented in those statistics. You can't find Brooks in his statistics. You can't find what he's doing in his statistics. You can find a very good player, but you cannot find what he's doing in there, other than how aggressive he is. Yes, he's good. He's good all the way through. He's good, even very good. But you can't find a player who's going to win 4 major championships in a very short span of time. So that's why I say he's an enigma. He shows up at the major championships and plays far better than there was any evidence that he would. So now he's won 4, and what I'm pulling for, what I'd love to see is, you know, how long has it been since we've seen anybody besides Tiger Woods win more than 6 major championships? You know, you have to go back to Tom Watson.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a long time ago, you know. But Tom had a span very much like Brooks.
And before that, a Gary Player.
And before that, Gary
and
Player.
And then after that, the ancients, except for Jack.
You know, Arnold Palmer. The faces on Mount Rushmore is who you're talking about. You know, okay, golf needs a bigger Mount Rushmore. Okay, we can't just settle at 3. You know, that seems to be where he's going. Now, there are so many pitfalls, you know, so many. You know, changing your swing, injuries, a personal misstep that causes you a huge distraction, complacency. Any of those are enough to extinguish the flame. And then it's gone. Nobody would have ever guessed that Tom Watson's last major was 83, right, or Palmer's was in 64. Nobody would have ever guessed that, or that Tiger wouldn't win another one
until
for a decade in 2008.
Yeah.
You know, the flame can burn out just as fast as it gets ignited. So the thing about Brooks, I think that is interesting, is that, one, he's still young. I love the fact that I know the people who want him to do the media hate it, but I love the fact that he doesn't want to get caught up in the hype of what he's done. He just wants to show up, tell you what he's going to do, waylace to everybody, and then go do what he needs to do. I kind of admire that. I think that probably allows him to do best what he needs to do. I think he's figured that out. I can't see him changing his golf. So it's not a golf swing that you would want to change. In other words, it's peculiar enough that it defies the need for change. You know, it's not aesthetically beautiful like Tiger's golf swing was in 2000, that it was almost so pretty that you thought, well, is he after the aesthetics or is he after what's going on here? I mean, so he was always tinkering with that golf swing. Tiger always tinkering. Mind you, it didn't bother him, but he's the exception. If you look at some of the more peculiar golf swings in the game, they are the longest lasting.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Ray Floyd was still winning golf tournaments right at 50. Jim Furyk is amazingly consistent. Lee Trevino won in his 40s major championship. Phil Mickelson is one of the more idiosyncratic golf swings I've ever seen, and he's still competitive at 40. These are long-lasting golf swings, and I think one of the reasons is that they are less inclined to tinker with them. They know them. They're theirs. They own them, you know, to some extent. They own these golf swings. And I think Brooks, he's got this move. He reminds me of this generation's Hale Irwin, which is somewhat, you know, yes, very much sort of over the top in transition. He's got a very similar right elbow move in transition that shallows the club out. You know, for him to, you know, he's almost got the same position at the top that Hale had. Now, he is, you know, 100 pounds heavier. I don't, you know, well, no, not 100 pounds. He's,
Hale was a great athlete, did play football, but he wasn't a power player.
But yeah. Not at all. Yeah. Hale's game was about precision, and it, that in, up, and over cut shot he had was dependable. And what I loved about the U.S. Open then was if you spend any time around Hale, you know in a very short period of time that he is a very bright man and that he's patient, and that, to me, he was the consummate U.S. Open champion. He had patience. He had a very high intellect, and he had a very dependable move. You know, Brooks is not 100 pounds heavier than Hale, but considerably more muscular than Hale was, and can lift 500 pounds more than Hale probably did. So he is this era's power Hale Irwin, is how I kind of look at him. And Hale's golf swing stood the test of time. It's an in, up, and over the, you know, Bruce Litsky kind of a move.
I used to talk to John Jacobs, the old teacher, not the player.
I just played with John Jacobs last week.
You got some stories then.
I do.
but John Jacobs is a wonderful man who studied the golf swing.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said that the most reliable way to repeat and stay out there and play professional golf was an in, up, and over the top move.
I couldn't agree more.
Sandy, you know, Sandy
in,
Lyle,
up, and over.
So many, yeah.
Do you need to see any more than Bruce Litsky?
Even Sam Snead, slightly.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So, I mean, Hogan. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost all the greats took it in, took it up, and took it over. Almost all of them. You know, almost all of them took the club way in. The left arm, you know, this insistence that the left arm goes straight back and the club stay outside your hands is unique to this generation. And again, it's another one of these things that is being
history doesn't prove.
Found some value for no apparent reason, just for aesthetics. And but Brooks has a mini Hale Irwin, a Bruce Litsky. These were incredibly consistent players with wonderful longevity. So the whole point there being, I don't see Brooks messing with his golf swing. I don't see Brooks. He seems incredibly unaffected by success, which is, you know, which is one of the things that made Tiger Woods Tiger Woods. You know, just as hungry after three majors as he was after two, or eight as he was after one. I mean, just success did not hobble him. Now, you know, off-course decisions ended up hobbling Tiger Woods, and that's part of his comeback story. So can Brooks avoid the pitfalls off of the golf course? Because those can ruin a career or stall a career as quickly as a bad back. And so these are all the things you look at with Brooks, and you think, I hope he goes on this incredible run, and we have another player. We haven't had one in almost four decades. Well, yeah, right at four decades, basically. Win more than six major championships. You know, he's won four, and he's not even 30 yet.
Maybe his gift is something intangible that's hard to measure. Maybe there will be a measurement for calmness and grit and clutch, but these things that allow him to
That's called the U.S. Open.
There you
or
go.
Or what it
yeah,
used
well,
to be.
Yeah, yeah. And this is going to be interesting because, you know, this is probably not the perfect setup for Brooks on paper, but nor was Shinnecock, although Shinnecock's a little wider probably than Pebble's going to be. So it'll be another place where he can prove that he has more game perhaps than he's been given credit for. But I do think there's something about his golf mind that is so far indecipherable, but I think it probably is the separator for him at the moment. I mean, the strength is there. There's no question. And he plays a good modern game, an incredible modern game. But he's able to dial it up in the biggest moments with the most penal golf courses. And that takes something special.
Well, look, this is a very timid generation of golfers. They're continually told what they're doing wrong. And they're seeking advice, and all their games are in a state of flux. To find someone who comes along with the belief that he has, it's shocking to see such complete belief in what he's doing and in himself. You know, golfers used to have more of an arrogance in the 60s and I'd say even in the 70s because they did dig it out of the dirt themselves. They felt like they owned it and it was theirs, and they were battle-hardened, so to speak. And they played with an incredible belief. That, to some extent, I think has been missing over the last generation and a half of golfers, because they're surrounded by people who are always changing and reminding them of their weaknesses. And they're looking for help from all these. And I think it establishes a more, and I'm not saying they're timid, I'm saying they're more timid than their predecessors.
Mm-hmm. As each generation may be in life in general.
You know, maybe they're aware of what they don't know.
Right.
But ignorance is empowering to some extent. And to believe that you are better than your peers, and to believe that your golf swing is the best out there and your game is the best out there, it's beautiful to see. You just don't hear someone speak so authoritatively about their game and their talents.
It's a great insight, and I think, you know, the fact that he wasn't really a part of the pipeline of, you know, the great young juniors and the college players. I mean, he was good, but he was never touted as that gave him this underdog aspect, and he started relying on himself more than people who were enabled by people telling him how great they were going to be.
Yeah, but most people who have that kind of belief are control players. You know, Trevino had that kind of belief. Mm-hmm. Nicklaus had that kind of belief. Hogan had that kind of belief. You know, where their words, their demeanor, their action, it was palpable that they knew exactly what they were going to do. I wouldn't think, nobody's going to call Brooks a control player. He's a power player with some control. But to hear somebody speak so confidently about what they're going to do is unique.
I think he's a control player mentally, and I think
that's a good point.
Yeah, I think he's got great mental control.
In control.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's well said. Well, you'd write that, and then see, I'd read that, and I'd go.
Writing down your
nice insight.
I'm writing down a lot of your phrases, and I'm going to put my own little spin, and it won't be complete plagiarism. But anyway, it's been a great pleasure, Randall.
One of Mumford's and Sons. You ever listen to Mumford and Sons?
I've heard them, sure.
They're a great band.
Yeah, heard them.
They said once that they steal lines from Shakespeare because it's easy to plagiarize Shakespeare because no lawyer's going to knock at your door. So just go to Shakespeare.
First kill all the lawyers. I think Shakespeare said that.
He did.
Well, thanks again, Randall. Great pleasure. We'll see you for episode 6 after the U.S. Open and probably right before the Open Championship.
Look forward to it, Jaime. Thanks.
Thank you.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.